Welcome, everyone. This is the LaRouche Show for Saturday, January 24th, 2009. My name is Marcia Mary Baker, and I'm with the Economics Desk of the EIR News Service. And I will moderate today a discussion on the general topic, American System Credit versus Imperialist Finance, the British Brutish Empire. You could also say Alexander Hamilton versus Hjalmar Schacht, if you wanted to personalize this. And we welcome to discuss this topic and some specifics that Lyndon LaRouche put forward this week in two international webcasts, actually over the last 8 days, one January 16 and one January 22nd. He put forward very specific ideas of what ought to be done about the world chain reaction of collapse that we now see worsening by the hour. We welcome to discuss this from the LaRouche Political Action Committee, the LaRouche Youth Movement in Washington, D.C., Jacob Johnson. Welcome.
Hello.
Hi. And from Houston, Texas, Tim Vance. Hi, Tim.
Howdy.
And these gentlemen are in key parts of the world, obviously Washington, D.C., the capital with its institutions and with all the new opportunity, challenges, and worries with the new administration, the new Congress, but also the Texas legislature is open. I guess it's only once every 2 years. But states around the country, as well as nations around the world, are reeling from the lack of solution to the financial system blowing out. So I know we'll hear more about this, and also the particular figures that Tim and Jacob have been researching and discussing with people who are leaders of the American system for the world, namely the first Treasury Secretary, Alexander Hamilton of the United States, and then the great leaders in the 1800s, Henry Clay, Henry Carey, who was economics advisor to Abraham Lincoln, and that is especially apt right now. The reason for why we want to hear about this is that we are still getting insane responses to the breakdown of the world financial system that LaRouche called the question on. He forecast it in recent years. Then in July 2007, he said, okay, folks, it's at hand. You're going to see things really blow out, but we can do something about it. He initiated the entire a kind of overall approach of putting a firewall between what functions you really want to have in economy so that they wouldn't be ruined by the blowout of what you don't want, all these gambling debts and wild speculation of recent decades, and put forward this draft legislation for Homeowners Bank and Protection Act that's getting tremendous attention. And he spelled out more in what I mentioned. I refer people to the LaRouche Political Action Committee website. That's LaRouchePAC.com, where you can see transcripts or you can see archived presentations by LaRouche on these two international webcasts, the 16th and the 22nd of January. So now we have at hand a situation where the empire advocates are going wild. I mean, George Brown, the Prime Minister of Britain, George Soros himself, he may live in the United States, but he's an agent of the British Foreign Office. They're saying more bailout, more bailout. Don't you dare do anything else except ruin your country. And yet we have a new administration and president, many of whom are saying, okay, the economy is a wreck. What we're going to do is rush a stimulus package through. But if anyone's looked at this $825 billion, you're going to see a kind of crazy to-do list of things like weatherizing buildings or computerizing medical records when millions of people are out of work, production is collapsing. Well, that's kind of where we stand. And that's why let's start with a particular proposal that Lyndon LaRouche gave on January 22nd for people to work through in their minds and actually implement is we need to freeze out the rotten credit, but rotten debts, unworthy debts, deep six them, but we need credit for reviving the economy, and for that we have a precedent in the institution of a national bank, which is constitutional. It was proposed, it was in effect for many years in the formation of the great American system economy as we grew as a nation. And that traces back to the vision of how an economy should work by Alexander Hamilton. So, Tim, why don't you start with the first Secretary of the United States and who he was and what, why LaRouche is referring to him to, for people.
Well, he's an absolutely unique individual, a very singular individual who's a part of our history as of the United States and is largely responsible for why, or that history of why the United States will play a leading role in the reorganization of the world financial system. and his example in the first administration of Washington is certainly a cue for the administration, the institutions of the presidency around Obama. And I think we can draw a lot from it. He was the first Treasury Secretary, but you'd be hard pressed to find any other individual who had done more in fighting the revolution against empire, establishing the republic, and securing the preservation of it through a financial policy, through the development of the vast territory of a new nation. And it was located in a fight and not a classroom, and that's what's very unique.
Let me ask you some specifics, but you may have general points. That's fine. But one thing is, he faced at the time a lot of unpayable debt. I think it was worthy debt, right? It was the debt that the colonies got into as colonies to then become the United States and fought a revolution against the British East India Company and the British Empire. But he dealt with it, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, that debt, I think, was worth it. As the first Treasury Secretary, he came into the office by himself, and it was an empty room, and he was able to transform that part of the executive into one of the larger sections of government and established the way that our government could finance itself. And you had a series of reports introduced into Congress at the request of Congress. And they were introduced, I think, a year apart from each other, beginning in January of 1790, later in December of that year, and then again in 1791. And they represented three different topics, but an integrated foundation for a new financial system premised on Republican values to secure the nation. The public credit, national banking, and subject of manufacturers. It's very hard to separate each of these from each other. They represent one coordinated program of preserving the Union, which Hamilton was clear that you had foreign interests that would do everything possible to prevent the rise of the United States through the development of manufacturers, and would do everything possible to instigate division amongst the states, rivalries, and that had to be stamped out through a strong national government. He had very practical concerns in establishing a new nation founded on Republican values.
And also, more about this, do you want to say more about those reports? In other words, characterizing kind of how to assay the condition of the country, I guess, mm-hmm. but the content of those reports?
Well, I think a good place to start would be the second one, the National Bank, because it was largely responsible for the. Let me put it this way: it was responsible for the creation of. Well, I'm sorry. Could you say your question again?
No, I was just saying, asking about. If you wanted to characterize any or all of those reports, because they give an idea of his view of how to survey the condition of the country from the point of view of what ought to be done about it. Just what you were saying about why you need a national bank, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's best answered by the purpose of the United States. It's found in the Constitution, the preamble. And you have goals of government, and it's pretty explicit with the United States to establish to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, and promote the general welfare and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity. So those are the goals of government, and in the eyes of Hamilton, a national bank was merely the instrument towards securing that. And we had a curious situation. We were a newfound nation. We had virtually no industry to ourselves. The 19 out of 20 Americans worked the land. We were wholly dependent on foreign powers for our supply of every basic good. This was something that Hamilton had learned firsthand from the revolutionary experience. And it was very hard to preserve that union without a vigorous national development of basic things like infrastructure. And this is one of the debates that went into the Constitution and the fight over national powers, because couldn't we maintain a confederacy of independent states? And one of the arguments was, well, it was just impractical to have such a vast empire. We could never maintain government over such a large continent. Well, that's true given basic technologies, but with the advent of internal improvements, transportation lines, communication and whatnot, you have the ability to orchestrate a national economy. And that national economy is absolutely critical for the well-being of the population. I mean, basic things like standards of living. And how could you defend your nation against what was known at that time to be foreign attempts to break up the United States into rival confederacies? How could you defend the United States against foreign powers without, say, the ability to manufacture your own guns, bullets, ships? How about clothing? And that's something that we learned that's part of the American experience at Valley Forge. Here you are fighting the world's largest empire, and you're short on just about everything, including the shoes.
Right. And so in that period, you're giving a very strong outlook. And in that period, the kind of nascent industries, I guess Eastern Pennsylvania, you know, they did have those early iron furnaces in New Jersey. But relative to what you'd need is a growing nation, completely insufficient, but at least a beginning, you know. Mm-hmm. So the idea was to further that, is what you're saying.
Absolutely. You had certain aspects of government that were granted by the Constitution that would have been impossible without such institutions. And I think the opposition to them, led by the faction which later became the Democratic Republican Party around Jefferson and Madison, was to cover an agenda. It was largely an agrarian dream to keep the United States an agricultural producing nation. It was Jefferson's idea that the United States could prosper and continue virtuous for centuries as a nation of independent farmers. And so that was the agenda that was used to prevent the establishment of these institutions.
So that was the domestic manifestation of this fight you're talking about, of mm-hmm. foreign empire interests trying to subvert the real development here. Do you want to say more about some people? Of course, these are necessary lessons of history, many of which people know nothing about today. But Hamilton also looked to power. You're talking about corridors of transportation to knit the far-flung lands together, and then kind of production complexes. He developed one for Paterson, New Jersey, right?
Yeah, with the I think it was the Society of Useful Manufacturers.
And how did that – what was involved in that?
Well, the idea was ahead of its time. That region of New Jersey would, in fact, I think 40 years after the experiment, succeed and vindicate the plans of Hamilton. But yeah, you had an industrial complex to produce all of the various requisite goods. Symptomatic of a independent sovereign nation.
And I think, and then the power question, that was, I think, all water power, naturally, because it was handy, I believe, there to harness it so you could get enough water wheels. Well, you mentioned this opposition faction. That's kind of a continuity up through the present day, I guess you could say, right? Or up through the what culminated in the Southern, the economy of the South, which said there should be no tariffs, and anything that agrarian or plantations needed, they could just get from abroad. Is that that's how you could characterize those decades?
Yes, I mean that's ostensible rationale, but you know, such things were promoted to render weak a weak nation, because nation states and governments tend to be a buffer between some of the more dangerous predator interests that exist in the world. And you know, being in Texas, you come across, you know, the anti big government types, mm-hmm. those who fear anyone else spending their own hard-earned money. But I mean, what you have to recognize is that the nation state, as outlined by LaRouche, and this is repeatedly emphasized throughout his writings and speeches, the nation state itself is the most effective and efficient means of protecting the population against this predator interest. And right now, it's fairly global, and it's going to be the government itself which surgically removes the this financial cancer that's really drawing life out of our real economy. It has been for some time, and it will be through a constitutionally based reorganization of the financial system.
You know, right. It was interesting that you brought up this continuation of the domestic empire fraction, so to speak. But I had noted the other day that through the course of our entire history, we've never really had more than 40 years before we've had an absolute financial panic. And there's always been a fight going on between a free trade, British, laissez-faire ideology and what was rooted back in the American system.
Right. One thing is that this gets into the specific, but on the technology question, which, Tim, you weren't – that was implied in your Society for Useful Manufacturers. Presumably you'd go for the advanced technology of the age, right? Mm-hmm. I happened to look at letters once that Jefferson wrote when he toured in Europe, a steam engine grist mill, you know, to mill flour from grain through steam power. And he said it didn't have really use value, he thought. Steam power only probably had a future for doing repetitive action things, like on the farm churning butter up and down, you know? When, of course, the advent of steam power was the whole next generation after water wheels and water power. So I think Jefferson meant that. I think he was a sincere person. but he was a handy person to manipulate for the British Empire. And so, in fact, let's go on to what Jake was talking about, the succeeding decades. But before we do that, mention specifically more about the National Bank. There was a U.S. National Bank, which many people don't know. When was it? There was a couple times, but 1791, then continued up to when? Before the British invaded Washington and the U.S.?
Yeah, it was allowed to expire prior to that, and it was reestablished. It's interesting because one of the leading congressional opponents against Hamilton's first national bank, Madison, was one of the more vociferous ones, had made a real break from Hamilton after writing the Federalist Papers. Later became, as president, you know, after the experience of the War of 1812, ironically, one of the leading proponents for the second national bank, and did everything within his power to establish it and promote. We had an entire tariff regime enacted after the War of 1812 from that experience. And I mean, there are particulars which aren't terribly exciting or necessary to go through in the course of this discussion, but you know, getting to this question of breaking free from a real delusion about money, rejecting that money itself has any inherent value. Nowhere is this more explicit in our own American experience than in fighting the Revolutionary War. I think everyone's familiar with the expression "ain't worth a continental dollar."
Yes.
Yeah. That was quite a dilemma. I think by the end of the war, I think something along the lines of 168 continental dollars worth, an actual dollar's worth of gold and silver. And this had plagued the entire war effort. And it really came to a head in a visceral way during Valley Forge. And this was the time period in which the idea of our first national bank was conceived. It was in the depths of winter at Valley Forge. And it was there when Hamilton came upon the camp. He witnessed snow stained in blood, 12,000 men shivering in log huts held together with mud. And all around was the stench of the rotting corpses of hundreds of dead horses. And ironically enough, these soldiers of our republic fighting the empire, fighting for the preservation of the American republic, they were just 22 miles outside of Philadelphia in some of the most fertile farmland in the region. And all around them was plenty, yet they would have none of it. They had a shortage in just about everything from blankets to shoes, clothing, guns, bullets, and more often, and the most shameful being food, because all around you had a good harvest. Yet these were not being sold to our troops.
Oh.
More often than not, when forced to accept the continental dollar at face value, which these patriots were being told, the farmers and merchants would hawk their wares to the well-fed and well-clad redcoats stationed nearby. And so it wasn't a question of money, right? It was a question of credit. And what was the credit of a government, especially at that time we had the Articles of Confederation, right, the perfect example of limited government. Anyone who loves limited government, should be truthful and admit that they aren't constitutionalists at all. They're anti-federalists, and the anti-federalists for our listeners were the ones who supported the original Articles of Confederation, the first attempt at a national charter, which denied basic powers of sovereignty to the federal to the national Congress. And so one of the big blunders, which was ratified in I think the November before Valley Forge, was you had this nation created that didn't have the ability to even tax, and they had no ability to raise funds. And so what would be the credit worthiness of a nation, of a government that couldn't raise funds, that couldn't even make a bullet, and yet were expected to take on the world's leading empire? Well, from that point of view, it wouldn't look too good, and you wouldn't put your money on it.
Right. But then that goes back to your original statement. Due to his leadership and others, right, of the time, he developed the office, the institutions, and the policies, and the nation came into being, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
And the credit worthiness. Jacob, then you have looked a lot, right, of the 1800s, the continuation of this fight, you could call it, and the continuation of those patriots like Henry Clay, who I think first came to the House of Representatives, during the War of 1812, 1811 maybe?
Yeah, it was right before. It was actually, funny enough, it was the Senate first.
Okay.
And he was underage, according to the Constitution.
Oh, but they seated him anyway?
Yeah, the Kentucky, because he had actually gone into the Kentucky state legislature.
Oh.
And then they had a spot to fill in the national Senate, and so he was elected to go there. But shortly after, he became Speaker of the House and remained in that position until the middle of the 1820s. But, yeah, he was one of these people that was part of the direct lineage of the Founding Fathers, so to speak.
Uh-huh.
You know, early on, he was born in 1777, so, you know, he was not able to fight in the Revolution.
But then, do you want to identify that period in which he was a leader, the expansion, you know, some of these policies, as Tim had said, of communications and transportation you know, the kinds of things he fought for and did come into being.
Yeah, yeah. The big thing that first happened was early on in the 1800s, about 1809, we had the British coming in and ransacking our commerce. They were basically pirating our ships and forcing our sailors into serving on their ships. And this didn't go over too well. So Henry Clay actually ended up founding the Warhawk Party, which was the party that said, we have to defend our national interest, which includes our commerce. And as it is right now, we're currently under British dominion. That this is a colonial system that they're subjecting us to. So we decided to wage war, and this was like the first major action made by Mr. Clay. Now, what was funny was he's in the House of Representatives. He ends up leaving to go in to negotiate the peace treaty. And then right when he gets back is when he starts talking about his American system. And he identifies, and one of his first actions is actually the beginnings of a national highway system, the famous Cumberland Road.
Mm-hmm. In Western Maryland, I think. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And he lays out a system of internal improvements where you're looking at channel navigation, you know, dredging of rivers, cleaning up swampland. And I mean, it's actually in a funny way going right at the Ricardo and Malthus doctrines of, you know, man inhabits the richest lands to cultivate on and then successively gets poorer and poorer lands as he exhausts the soil.
Yes, I think I mentioned to you in his Harmony of Interests, he uses an example from central Pennsylvania and Center County and others. There's a thing called the Bald Eagle Valley. And they definitely settled the ridges first, which is very poor, scrubby land. And then decades later came down into the bottom land, just the opposite of Ricardo.
Yeah. Yeah, it's quite humorous because, you know, it just takes a lot of work, and you got to dredge swamps to get that rich land.
Right.
So yeah, it was only after having a national effort like that where the federal government comes in and says, okay, you know, rich Virginia playboy is not going to pay, you know, start improving his own lands when he's sitting there using slave labor, you know, trying to get the cheap way out already. So they said, all right, we're going to build a national agenda, and we're going to provide the money ourselves. We don't have to, you know, depend on private interest to develop the land. We can do it. Which kind of, I mean, it gets at an essence of a credit system, where the intention lies there.
And then the second period of the National Bank, again for people to know, came, I think you mentioned, but what, 1816 or so, up until there was a populist attack, and it was stopped yet again, right?
Right, by Mr. Andrew Jackson.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, during that time period, from 1816 up until 1832. It was very interesting because Mr. Clay had given a speech in 1824 where he had laid out, we were still under kind of a free trade idea, trying to recover our shipping, these kinds of things, and eventually had gotten tariff policies in as a protection for internal manufacturing, as well as the agricultural industries, because they had also been failing. And he describes this horrible state of poverty. We had just gotten the National Bank back. In 24, we started to achieve legislative victory, so to speak. And immediately, the nation started improving everything. I mean, just the simple means of existence for people, work, food, all became much more abundant. People had their standard of living had started to increase. And our, you know, we got out of the deficit. Mm-hmm. Very important for them. They wanted to reestablish this credit. And it wasn't until the middle of the 1830s when speculation comes in. We started deregulating, you know, eliminating the tariffs, and wild bubble started to build up. And then Jackson comes in and has all kinds of crazy schemes with how to reorganize the banking system. And it collapsed in on itself.
Yeah, so that was... So on this fight, I understand that, in fact, there was, you described this improvement of existence, and there was a sense of it, and then I think it was 1832 or something that the National Congress approved a continuation of the bank, but Jackson vetoed it, or in other words, it was that degree of fight, right?
Oh, yeah. It's very interesting, because the other big event that happened in 1832 was South Carolina wrote up what's called the Nullification Proclamation, mm-hmm. and they basically said that South Carolina doesn't have to obey federal laws regarding the tariff, and they were going to, I mean, essentially secede from the Union. So, I mean, what became the Civil War, you know, dates back decades, and this is where, you know, Clay is known as the Great Compromiser.
Right.
He came in saying, look, we have to preserve the Union, and so we're going to have to find a position here and try to defuse the conflict. But the National Bank was also a direct part of that.
Right.
And that sweep of the decades you just described is a perfect example of what Mr. LaRouche is speaking of when he talks about the threat of peace breaking out in regions like the Middle East. And in general, the danger, or at least in the minds of a parasitical financial class, the danger of development. You know, what happens if the Eurasian continent develops, or if Africa is lifted out of poverty, or if wages are raised in Latin America? The threat of that, because going back to this example of South Carolina with the Nullification Act, I mean, really, what was the fight? You know, what is implied by this question of tariffs? Well, a sound trade policy, backed up with a sound financial policy, would necessarily promote a type of economy which would render slavery inadequate. It would render it wouldn't work, and needless to say, where, you know, you described the Ohio River Valley and such regions, but wherever the American system was implemented, you had an increase in standard of living. You had the differences in wages minimized, and you had growth in population. And, you know, from the standpoint of even, you know, the political ramifications of that, as more and more free states grew in population, the kind of chokehold that the Southern British-backed Confederacy had over national politics would be wrested from them. Control over national decision-making would be taken away from these Southern states by more numerous and more populous free states. So the political ramifications of development are very explicit in that whole history you described, Jacob. It's very interesting.
Yeah, no, it's very funny. A few decades later, Carey goes through the entire English school of political economy and is very thorough and gives you a vivid picture of how the British system works. And, you know, and he describes all of the colonial interests, Ireland, Scotland, India, and he just goes through how, you know, Ireland, I mean, as an example, is a country that was in extreme poverty. But it was poverty that was enforced on them because they had all of the lands. You know, you've got people sitting there in these mud shacks with no work and some of the richest agricultural lands in the world around them. But they were just put into debt and, you know, with rent, these kinds of Ricardo's doctrines, and told that, you know, food increases slower than population. And you'll always be poor.
Yeah, and of course the monoculture of enforced single crop potato production.
Yeah.
Unfortunately it happened. It can be inevitable. It was the 1840s and then the blight set in.
Marcia, that was actually a secondary crop. That was a reaction to the cash crop of Ireland at that time, which was beef.
Oh yeah, they were forced to, yeah.
Absolutely. Under the dictates of free trade, it was by far the more profitable. And so the most of the lands were converted to cattle raising. And, you know, what peripheral lands existed were rather poor, and the only crop that could grow there was the potato.
Right. And, that raises... Jacob, you mentioned Henry Carey, who laid bare what the English system is, and he also outlined a lot of principles explicitly, right? When you were talking about Henry Clay, I was mentioning one of Henry Carey's books. I jumped the gun.
Oh yeah.
It was the same refutation of Ricardo by actual experience in America, but do you want to go through again some of the principles that Henry Carey was making explicit and also then were seen in the Lincoln policies and the actual development of the land base of the hinterland of the United States.
Yeah, sure. It's what's funny is that, you know, you've got this line of succession of people, you know, I mean, the work you referenced, The Harmony of Interest, was I think published first in about 1854, so right before the Civil War. And, you know, in there, what he lays out is that essentially Hamilton's policy, that you don't have to have, you know, the Jefferson agrarian, you know, agricultural society, and neither is it the case that, you know, you're going to have some kind of manufacturing dictatorship with... It's actually funny. The extreme guys, you know, Democrats in the South were always lambasting the North as trying to enslave all of the South and become the serfs of a Northern dictatorship. And but that there exists a harmony between agriculture, between manufacturing, and between commerce. And he looks at the development of consumption and production being something that you want to eliminate as much as possible the excess. For example, he considers it ridiculous to, you know, produce, extract raw iron in the United States and then send it by a ship over to England where they manufacture it into rail, which then they ship back to the United States so that we can lay track for our rail, where we could simply build our own manufacturing here, which will suddenly supply more labor for, you know, in raw material development. But then once this rail is laid, it becomes now you minimize the entire middleman process, which, you know, it's humorous in that you've got one man who's producing raw materials. Then you have another man in Britain who's producing refined materials. And in the middle, you spend all of this time to support somebody who doesn't produce anything. All they do is consume. And he describes a process where, really, in society, you have men that can only consume to the fullest extent of their production. And so once you've got people that aren't producing anything, where their life is just spent consuming, you basically build an entropic, downward sliding society. And so his idea is that you can develop the United States through increasing the actual ability for people to produce through technological advance. And, you know, this came in with rail, this came in with steamboats, better and better steamboats, and through concentration of power into areas that you would have, like it's a similar plan that Mr. LaRouche has laid out with development corridors, where you centralize the ability to produce such that you eliminate the spreading out and diversification of resources over vast expanses, which require time and a loss of heat, a loss of power to produce.
And on the technology side, I know whether it's Alexander Hamilton, Henry Clay, Henry Carey, there may be things you want to say, as Mr. LaRouche has been hammering in recent decades, but in the last few months and days, that it's not just a question of make work. That gets into this crazy guy, John Maynard Keynes, saying just dig holes or rake leaves or crazy stuff. But I think Henry Clay, for example, one thing I'd seen once is his letters he wrote backing Mr. Fulton. Was that Robert Fulton, the steamboat developer?
Yeah.
Because Fulton had the idea for underwater torpedoes, which he had worked on in France. And Henry Clay was in a big rush to see if they could get them in time to work in the New York City harbor against the British men of war, you know?
Yeah.
But there are other examples, or that one, maybe you want to say something about, of really advanced technology of the period. You mentioned steam, rail, and so forth.
Just as a funny side note, my friend was reading a book by Mr. Keynes recently who suggests that we take specie, gold,
okay,
and bury it, and then pay people to dig it up.
Okay.
As an actual proposal.
All right. That's better than leaves. Is that supposed to be? Okay.
So, yeah, I don't know if he was going to count the newly acquired gold as a doubling up of our in our vaults.
Oh, yeah, you could count it several times, probably.
Right. Yeah. You know, geometric growth.
Well, let me just ask either one of you about something, these lessons as they pertain with creating a situation today for people to think in this way. It's not an overnight thing. It's not because they just didn't study or something. But I think, Tim, you mentioned this in Texas. Texas is world famous, isn't it, for this? You're not going to give us big government down here. So maybe I think you personally have been in Austin, the state capital, on dozens of meetings, that we have to take the kind of Alexander Hamilton or Henry Carey or Lyndon LaRouche approach today. What's happening? Is some of their worldview crumbling, their culture crumbling?
Well, I mean, you have two types of the particular kind you just referenced. The sillier kinds, even speak of secession today, independent Texas Republic, if it gets that bad. But for those who are intellectually honest, I think when you challenge them as a patriot on these issues and drawing from the wealth of the history that Jacob just went through with Clay and Carey and singular individuals like Hamilton, you can get an interesting response, and I think it's key. So LaRouche's call for the creation of a national bank going Hamilton is really ideal. Mm-hmm. And our work in the State House in Austin centered around the continued push for the adoption of the HPPA, LaRouche's Homeowners and Bank Protection Act. Long overdue, but still vital and necessary. And too many of these legislators, it's a real slap in the face. It's everything they've grown accustomed to. And one of the more humorous responses is Section 3 of the HBPA.
Okay, can you go through that?
Which calls for the principles of the HBPA in terms of erecting a firewall to save the national and state chartered banks. You know, the legitimate purposes of banking, which well understood by Hamilton and other such figures, you would preserve that and at the same time prevent a total social catastrophe by keeping people in their homes.
Mm-hmm.
But the third aspect of the bill itself calls for putting that administration, those policies, those purposes, under the care of each state governor. And we have an interesting governor here in Texas. And they would have their faces in the text of the legislation that we were asking them to endorse, or draft a resolution of memorializing the HBPA to the federal Congress.
Right.
And they would take it well until they got to the third option, and then they would look up and asked if we had in fact spoken to the governor. But we had to, inform them, and given our lessons in history, that the national government is sovereign. It's the law of the land. So I don't think the governor here in Texas, at least, would have a choice whether or not he would be willing to administer it. So, it's certainly interesting.
I'd have to carry it out. And, by the way, we have an email come in and from Adam. I hope he's still listening. I am going to put it to our guests in a minute. It will enable you maybe to recap some of your points. But, Tim, do you want to say anything about the scene in Washington in terms of any of the institutional layers you experience or just people on the street? I think you might have been there with 1.8 million people this week for the inauguration. Is that true? Or did I say Jacob?
Sorry,
did I say Tim? I meant Jacob. I'm not confused. I'm just in the wrong state. Go ahead.
Yeah, the overwhelming general feeling of people here is one of excitement. They know that we're on the edge of doom, but they're also excited in that Bush and Cheney are gone. How can you not be excited? But there's also, it's actually humorous, we were at an American Enterprise Institute event, which around here is euphemistically called the Temple of Doom. And speaking there was Phil Graham.
Oh, yeah, he was carried on C-SPAN. Go ahead.
Yeah, and he, this is the guy that tore down the Glass-Steagall Act, which was, what we have called for reinstating, separating investment speculation and commercial banking. And at this event he was called out, said, look, why, we had regulation at one point, we tore it down. Is it really that surprising that we got in a crisis? In fact, it was forecasted. And of course he says, who forecasted this? And one of our organizers said, well, LaRouche forecasted this, which of course had somewhat destabilized him. And then later on in the questioning, he was asking, why are you so afraid to recognize and admit that the system's bankrupt? It's dead. Why are you afraid to let it go? Why don't you just let it go?
Mm-hmm.
And his response was actually interesting because he took the question seriously. And he said, in essence, what his response was is that I'm not ready to admit that.
Uh-huh.
Which I think is interesting because it's not that the system isn't dead. It's just that he's not quite ready to admit it yet.
Right.
And this is coming from a man who, was instrumental in tearing down the regulations. So I think it is recognized that LaRouche was right on this and that it is dead. Whether they're ready to admit it or not is a different question, but it's a step in the right direction.
Right. Well, let me put this email to either one of you from Adam, who sends his greetings, and he says, if I were an economist, which I'm not, and trained by the empire to believe that money has intrinsic value, and trained to think of the economic system strictly from a linear perspective, Cartesian, but could you explain to me how increasing national deficit held by the Treasury under an American system, credit-based system, would not necessarily mean we're bankrupting ourselves in the process? Adam says, I think many people, especially those educated in finance, have a big misunderstanding of this. And Adam also said he's thinking specifically of what Andrew Jackson did, his traitorous measures to eliminate the national bank. So I think you both have talked about it, but on the question of what a big deficit would mean, do either one of you want to talk about this?
Yeah, I like the example of NASA, where there's several that you can take. Roosevelt, with how much he spent, it was billions and billions of dollars, and then the war deficit after that. But really, most of the time the budget was relatively balanced through the New Deal era. But NASA is almost a better example of a science driver that gives back to the economy in ways that people don't expect. When you invest in an infrastructure project, you don't necessarily expect to get a direct return on it. And this is the famous case with infrastructure all over the country. You invest in a water system. Well, a water system's not very profitable. But what is it about increasing the actual productive powers of people, their standard of living, that enables them to be more productive? And suddenly, the revenue that you're bringing in is increased without, not directly from the infrastructure, but indirectly from what the infrastructure achieves with society.
Yeah, let me throw in here one thing I recommend Adam do if he hasn't not done it already. If he looks on the LaRouche Political Action Committee website, LaRouchePAC.com, LaRouchePAC.com, at something that's been up about a week or 10 days on the water projects for North America, the North American Water and Power Alliance and the Northwestern Mexico Hydraulic Program called Plano. And there's a lesson in there through an animated cartoon about bringing electricity and power to bear and how it affects the whole system. Or if you take it away, it doesn't just turn. Go ahead.
That's a perfect example of what I would recommend to a run-of-the-mill economist or an accountant. Go out there and get your hands dirty. Get some experience with the real world out there, because it might be a little different than what's on your balance sheet. And I would say that one of the biggest criticisms coming from the Jeffersonian faction of the Congress at the time of the Report on Public Credit, which insisted on the assumption of the various wartime debts of the states into one national debt, that you're dealing with two physically different things. The debt incurred, was at that time was to fight a revolution against empire, to secure a nation, and that's an investment. And there's no problem assuming those debts if you're confident, right? If you have faith in the nation in which you're committed to seeing succeed. And if we have a successful nation, such the debts can be amortized, right? But if we lose all employment and we're living in mud huts, it's going to be very hard to manage those debts. Unfortunately, the way the financial system has been set up, that's what we're doing. We're taking people out of the payrolls and kicking them out of their homes. And in that situation, we can't do it. But what we're proposing in terms of international projects of infrastructure, let's not kid ourselves. It's going to be trillions of dollars. And this is going to be annually. This is not going to be a one-shot deal. This is going to be trillions of dollars invested over time. But through an increase in productivity, through the stability, peace, and prosperity, we'll get to that. But that's a secondary consideration.
And one thing let me ask you, I don't know if Jacob wants to say something about this from Washington's point of view, but this we haven't used a lot the word globalization, but that's what Jacob and Tim have been talking about, right? In the whether it's 1791, the 1800s, it's this foreign, a private elite self-described imperial financial interests and literally the British East India Company trying to dictate to the world. And now we have globalization. It's just it wouldn't have been useful in the last 40 years if these financial interests had said, we want to have a new British East India Company. But that's what we're up against, right?
Yeah. It was very humorous. On the way to the Congress not too long ago, I was with a friend, and in the subway, we had heard some people talking next to us about how, you know, the new globalized economy and things have never been this way, but the last 40 years of development with globalization, and my friend turned to them and said, yeah, you know, trade didn't exist 60 years ago.
They probably just shut up, right?
Yeah, they got quiet kind of quick. And it's just, no, the British weren't controlling global trade with the British East India Company, a couple hundred years ago. That was the case. It's just the mechanism by which they do certain things that changes. The system is essentially the same.
Right. And one or both of you whom I talked to recently was raising the question, let's use an overused term. It's scary these days. It's not as if you can go and see even, half a person who's half the stature of Alexander Hamilton or of Henry Clay. Now, we have Lyndon LaRouche, who, when it comes to stature, stands for all time. So that's another way to look at the equation, right?
Yeah.
But what do you find either in Washington or Texas, about the people understanding the dynamic of there is no other fight, but we have an opportunity? Let me ask you about that. Do you think that in Texas that's the you can see a shift that more people will enlist as what you said, the ongoing fight, for example, the Homeowners and Bank Protection Act?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think the fact that, just 2 weeks ago we were able to go into the Capitol and have over 40, 50 meetings with various offices is symptomatic of that. And a good number of them did recognize that we had proposed the very same legislation before the crime, as Lyndon LaRouche would put it, before the crime had occurred.
Before the bailout and everything else?
Before the bailout, absolutely.
Okay. That was a big, uh-huh.
Yeah, that was recognized in not a few places, and I think the opportunity is there, and I think that the seriousness of the response was certainly there, and I mean, as reality comes to bear, I think largely they'll have no choice, but we have to be firm on the principles around which we're organizing, so that they can move quickly and efficiently, and fortunately LaRouche has been explicit in what the program is to be. I mean, listeners, I invite you to review the webcast. It couldn't be more clear. They're virtually marching orders for the incoming Obama administration. And, we need to prepare ourselves, arm ourselves with this history so we can, effectively judo. Not insist on really discussing their criticisms of big government or, well, how does this work, and yada, yada, yada. Largely, the opposition is mute, It wouldn't stand in a court of law. That's what I would say.
Well, the one thing, let me just underscore that people should look on the website and contribute, activate, give money, give resources. I recommend speaking from the EIR news service, and you're listening on LaRouchePub.com, LaRouchePub.com, but some of you are listening on telephone message lines all around the Americas. And if you subscribe, donate, and the LaRouche Political Action Committee, this fight, it's a fight to the death, and we're committed to win, but the resources are needed, as you just heard, the whole mobilization in state capitals. There's Texas, there's states all around the country. In fact, there's a recall announced underway. Mr. LaRouche put his put this forward for California, where the whole state, the biggest in the country and one of the biggest economies in the world, is falling apart. We should recall Arnold Schwarzenegger. So it's time to give of time and money. And as I say, LaRouche Political Action Committee, LaRouche.com. I think we're out of time. Maybe you can just say goodbye, Jacob. Anything else?
No, thank you for having me on, though.
And thank you very much, Tim Vance in Houston, Texas. And very please listen weekly. We're from 3 to 4 Eastern Time in the United States. And I think January 31st, we want to talk about sweeping George Soros and drug legalization off the planet. Thank you very much. This is January 24th, 2009. Marsha Mary Baker.